Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Strategies for Success in Adult Immunization, which is certified by the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases and presented by William Schaffner, MD, Kristen Nickel, MD, MPH, MBA, and Richard K. Zimmerman, MD, MPH. Dr. Schaffner is a professor of medicine, chair, Department of Preventive Medicine, Division of Infectious Diseases, Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, Nashville, Tennessee, President, National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Dr. Schaffner has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Pfizer, Merck & Company, GlaxoSmithKline, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Dynavax Technologies Corporation, and Sanofi Pasteur. Dr. Schaffner does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Schaffner does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Nickel is a professor of medicine, University of Minnesota Medical School, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Chief of Medicine, Minneapolis VA Medical Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Dr. Nickel has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, Merck & Company, GlaxoSmithKline, MedImmune, and Sanofi Pasteur. Dr. Nickel does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Nickel does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Zimmerman is a professor, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and Graduate School of Public Health, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Dr. Zimmerman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Merck & Company, MedImmune, and Sanofi Pasteur. Dr. Zimmerman does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Zimmerman does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to provide clinically meaningful education that will ultimately assist healthcare providers in overcoming barriers and enable them to adopt timely, appropriate vaccine recommendations and immunization policies into clinical practice. This activity is supported by Merck & Company and Pfizer. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner, the chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, and president of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. I'd like to welcome you to this CME certified activity entitled Strategies for Success in Adult Immunization. I'd like to introduce my colleagues, Dr. Kristen Nickel, who is the professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota and associate chief of staff for research at the VA Medical Center in Minneapolis, and my colleague, Dr. Richard Zimmerman, who's professor of family medicine with a joint appointment in the Graduate School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh. Now, let's jump right in. Kristen, I have a question for you. So what problems are we seeing as a result of low vaccine uptake among adults?
Well, of course, the major problem that we're seeing is that we are seeing substantial disease burden that could be prevented in adult populations in this country. It's important for all of us to realize that there are hundreds of thousands of adults every year who become ill due to influenza, pneumococcal disease, hepatitis B, tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, and other vaccine-preventable diseases in this country, tens of thousands of people die due to vaccine-preventable diseases in this country. Why is that? Well, in part, it's because we have low vaccination rates in adults for these and other vaccines that are recommended for adults in this country. Again, hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations, tens of thousands of deaths due to influenza every year. Invasive pneumococcal disease is still a big deal in this country for adults. Tens of thousands of cases, over 4,000 deaths every year, and the list goes on. Purely preventable disease. Well, why is this? Well, let's think a little bit about vaccination rates in this country. I said that vaccination rates are too low. Well, they're really too low for adults. Fortunately, in this country, we've had much better success in vaccinating our children, and that's a great thing. Yeah. We are so proud of that success story. But with adults, let's think about this. Baseline rates, when we think about baseline rates in this country, we're thinking about rates that help us understand where we are and where we need to go. For example, getting to the year 2010 healthy people goals. In this country, influenza vaccination rates, baseline rates in the year 2008, were only 25% for adults 18 to 64, as opposed to the goal of 80%. For people 65 and older, one of the high priority target groups, the baseline rate was between 60 and 65%, as opposed to a goal of 90%.
And of course, the recommendation is that we should all be immunized.
Well,
right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. We have these 2010 goals, which are goals we would like to see us getting to 100%. And these gaps between the baseline rates and the goals are there for all of the vaccines for adults. With pneumococcal disease, 60 to 65% have been vaccinated, as opposed to the 90% goal, and 100% ideal. And we are doing even less well for the other vaccines that are recommended for adults. For example, the shingles vaccine, yeah, where in 2008 only 7% of people 60 and older had been vaccinated, and with other vaccines as well.
One of the things that I've been struck with the rates is also the racial disparity in rates. And so that we see gaps between those who are persons of color, persons of black background, particularly having much lower 10-20% gap from the absolute vaccination rate of whites, and Hispanics often in between, but actually approaching that of whites. And so that racial gap, it troubles me in particular, and it also troubles me because for certain diseases there is a genetic basis or an environmental basis that places those who are minorities at a higher risk for disease, from the burden of disease. So it's a double whammy: lower vaccination rates and a higher risk of disease.
Consider, for example, exactly on that point, if we look at 2009 data for the United States from the National Health Interview Survey, if we look at influenza vaccination rates for people 65 and older, if you look at non-Hispanic whites, the vaccination rate was 68.6%. For non-Hispanic blacks, as you said, the vaccination rate dropped to 50.8%, and for Hispanics, it was 50.6%. Similar disparities were seen with pneumococcal vaccination rates for the elderly. So this disparity adds to the real challenge that we have in this country in terms of getting the vaccine to our adults to prevent all of this illness, needless suffering, needless hospitalization, and needless death in many cases.
So I'm going to follow up on this a little bit, Kristen. What are the major causes of low immunization rates among adults, which you have described now so well? As we used to say in New Jersey, how come?
Well, that's a great question. And, of course, there are a number of reasons. I think of the reasons as falling into several different kinds of categories. We think of issues that are important for our patients or the customers. We think of issues that are important for physicians. Of course, policy and vaccine supply and reimbursement are also very, very important. But some of these issues, just focusing perhaps a bit on providers and patients, for providers, one of the real challenges that we have, especially in adult medicine, is that we miss opportunities in the clinical setting. We might forget We're focused on acute illness or chronic illnesses rather than prevention and the vaccines that our patients need. And for patients, they may not have ever heard their provider recommend. And of course, both patients and providers struggle, I think, with misinformation, misperceptions, and unfounded concerns about vaccines.
Excuse me, but you said something about patients not having heard the recommendation. You know, the NFID has done a recent survey, and when providers are asked, do you recommend vaccines, they say, oh, yeah. About 80% of them say yes. But when the patients are asked, only 20% of them have said that they've actually heard a provider really recommend that they should be vaccinated. So what we think we're doing, that message is not getting through to our patients.
Exactly. Disparities between perceptions and performance, that's how I think of this provider recommendation issue. And I think we would all agree that provider recommendation has been demonstrated to be among the most potent predictors of vaccination.
Absolutely.
And if a provider gives a clear, unequivocal recommendation to their patients, the patient is very likely to be vaccinated even if they're otherwise negatively disposed. Provider recommendation is very important. And these missed opportunities.
Yeah, talk about them.
Oh, well, Rick, you know about missed
yes.
opportunities because you've studied this, but in many cases, over 50% of patients needing an influenza vaccination during that season had an encounter with the healthcare system and didn't get offered the vaccine or didn't get immunized.
Yeah, they walked out the door unimmunized.
They did. And with pneumococcal vaccination, which of course for most patients is once in a lifetime, if you look over a 3-year period, oftentimes patients will have had 5 or 10 encounters mm-hmm. with the healthcare system where they weren't assessed and vaccinated. So these missed opportunities, they're so common.
So do primary care providers actually recommend vaccine?
Well, this survey that you quoted suggested that providers believe that they are recommending, or they may report that. On the other hand, another study that looked at whether or not providers report that they are recommending these vaccinations actually showed that the providers didn't even indicate that they strongly recommend some vaccinations for their patients. For example, in one survey of primary care practitioners across the country from a few years ago, when asked, do you recommend influenza vaccination for different patient groups, only 37% said they strongly recommend for the elderly, for people with chronic lung disease, only 45% recommended. With pneumococcal vaccination, interestingly, in this study, the percent of providers indicating that they strongly recommend was a little higher at about 65% for the elderly and 68% for lung disease.
Yeah, but here we those have... Those are still low numbers.
You know, why is this? Well, I just wanted to acknowledge that in addition to missed opportunities and the importance of provider recommendation, I would just like to acknowledge that patients do need to be aware. They need to be aware of disease, the vaccines that are available, and their personal risk. And surveys sponsored by the NFID and others have shown that many people are not aware of these diseases, the vaccines, and their personal risk. Again, provider recommendation. And then these issues of misconceptions and fears. Are the vaccines safe? Do they work? Can I trust the healthcare system and people who are recommending?
You know, that's a big issue in pediatric and immunization, of course. But there's spillover to adult immunization, mm-hmm. I expect.
Yeah, many of my patients will say, well, somebody got flu from an activated flu vaccine. We've heard that I don't know how many times. And, of course, not true. You can't get flu from an inactivated vaccine. But that persistent myth is there. It's there in the patient populations. And we have to really work hard to overcome it.
Right.
Exactly. And, you know, again, surveys of consumers have suggested that people think they're healthy. They and of course they probably are, but they don't understand that even healthy people need vaccinations. Or, well, my doctor hasn't told me I need it, so it must, you know, must not be important, and this concern about side effects.
So, Rick, I'd like to get you into this. adults seem to fall into two immunization groups, kind of. Those who initiate a visit, they're interested in an immunization, influenza immunization. A lot of people over age 65 actually will come in and ask for it, or if they're going traveling. But then there are those who do not, which is the larger group. How can we tailor our efforts to those groups? How can we take advantage and rectify some of these things that Kristen has been talking about?
Sure. Well, for those who want to access immunization services, we really want to make them convenient. And this is particularly true during flu season. And we have the rise of the different options for being vaccinated, whether you go to the primary care or you go to a non-traditional source. So we really want convenience to be key. And for those who will make a visit to our offices for flu vaccine, whatever we can do, and you've done a lot of this work, Kristen, and I likewise, at looking at convenience, express vaccination stations, after evening hours that are only dedicated to flu, or a weekend day that's only dedicated to vaccinations. And those express services really make a difference. But our patients need to know about them. Because if we offer express services and they don't know about it, they can't access it. And so we need ways to tell our patients. In the old days, that might have been a postcard. But I think more and more people are moving to other communication means, and autodialers, I think, are right now the sweet spot for a way, in a cost-effective manner, to get the word out. We are having express vaccination services. There can be other ways as well. Some will use email, some will use text. I know that we're in the process of learning how to do that under HIPAA and in ways that are compliant with privacy guidelines. But right now, I think the auto dialer is the easiest way. Hmm. Now, for those who come in, be it for a chronic care visit or an acute care visit or the easy one, a well adult visit, then we need to make sure that we address immunization. And we have to have a system that's in place. And there are several different ways to do this. One way that my office has done is to use vaccination as part of vital signs. So the nurse, when they're doing vital signs, and now that smoking has been part of a vital sign along with weight and blood pressure, we have also added this issue of vaccination status. And the nurse can ask and query the record. We actually have it programmed where the last date of vaccinations are placed automatically into the nursing note, that is the vital sign note, so they don't have to go hunt. Other systems will do this with EMR prompts and alerts that will flash yellow, due for flu vaccine, and puts it right in front of the person with an automatic alert. Depends on your EMR and how it's programmed. But I think that a routine assessment, vital signs, or an EMR systematic piece is key. And then you have to vaccinate routinely. And that can be done by standing orders, which standing orders being those orders that a physician or a group of physicians sets for the practice and then enables nurses or other personnel to go ahead and carry out vaccination by the physician-approved protocol. You've studied this in Minnesota for many years.
They make all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
You systematize, you automate the assessment of patients and the administration of vaccination by qualified personnel.
And you had to train those personnel to do that.
Of course, and they have to be qualified in the state, according to state law. But nurses and pharmacists and other healthcare personnel are fully qualified most places to go ahead and assess patients and vaccinate.
Great. So,
and the other part of that we've seen some systems in EMR that use smart sets, and so into the electronic encounter is, you've got your background information, your physical exam, and then built into it is immunization status. And so you can't escape seeing immunization status. It's built right in, and if you click the right things, it automatically creates an order and creates the bill. And so some of these smart systems, you can't miss immunization. But those are often set up for well visits. And so you have to also think about what's going on with acute care visits and diabetes and chronic care visits. But for many of the well visits, the smart cells will just take you right through, and it, you have to almost not vaccinate. But it's really nice for at least the well adult visits.
And it sounds like you have a very well-developed electronic medical record system, and you are really leveraging that to help support the delivery of preventive health care services such as vaccinations. But even for providers who maybe haven't made that full transition yet, and of course, more and more are there, at least partially, there are a variety of other tools, checklists, and paper records that can be used. And even though we're getting more and more into the electronic era for reminding patients, some practices will have newsletters that go out to patients, and those can be a vehicle. And even some systems still use the postcard or the letter, and, you know, being recognizing the importance of privacy and so on, one can still use a variety of tools.
I didn't think anybody knew what a postcard was anymore, but good for them if it works.
I think veterinarians do.
Another thing I wanted to say that we have noticed in our research that when we try to help a practice and we go in, we get an impact for a month or two as they have really tried to do the right thing and improve their quality. But it's interesting. The flu season comes and goes. We've put our intervention in the flu season. And pneumococcal vaccines are given more when we're doing that. But then they begin to trickle off. They get fewer. And what I've seen from that and what I've concluded is while I want to encourage standing orders all year long, there is the issue of coupling pneumococcal vaccine, Tdap, and others with flu, because that coupling really has the whole office focused on vaccination, and I think is the way for us to really expand the coverage for pneumococcal, for tetanus, for zoster, and these other vaccines by adding them on to flu.
You know, I like that. I personally haven't had an experience that really works. I mean, in our neck of the woods, folks have been more concerned that during influenza season, they're very interested in throughput. People want to come in, they want to be vaccinated very, very quickly and move on through, rather than to take the time and review the immunization record and hold up the line to give that individual two immunizations, for example. How do you see that working?
Well, I think each office has to figure out their way of doing it. Some offices use express services during the day, and I think with that, it's not quite as factory like as some of the evening clinics have been. And in those situations, I think it's very possible to couple on. I will admit it's a little more difficult to do that if you're in the 2 minutes flu vaccine very express evening clinic. For those when throughput is meant to be a couple of people, you know, within 5 minutes, so that you really have 2 minutes, 3 minutes per person before they're through the assembly line type of caregiving, then it may be difficult to assess some of the others. But certainly we can do it with the express clinics during the day.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No,
I was just going to pick up on this idea of the express clinic, or in my neck of the woods, we sometimes talk about walk-in clinics. I think it's really the same notion.
Yes.
But what I've seen in some places is to set up these walk-in clinics or express clinics, to use your terminology, where they might have two stations. One for influenza vaccination, but then rather than having multiple vaccines given at one station, then the patient can move on to a different station to get a different vaccine. And that way you maintain throughput and are still able on occasion to leverage the opportunity to give more than one vaccination. I also wanted to just say I really agree with your statement that each clinic needs to look at its own situation and develop processes that work for them. No one size really fits all for different clinic settings, and it's so important that within a particular practice that they figure out what works for them so that the effort can be sustainable. You can do almost anything once, but if you really apply the good principles of quality improvement, you design a process that you can repeat year after year.
Well, Rick, you've had a slide here that shows that there are some barriers but also solutions to implementing standing orders and getting people immunized. You have to make sure that you do have sufficient staff and that they're well trained. And obviously, they need the resources to do this and the commitment from the practice.
That's true. You do need to have enough staff. And we have known, I know of one practice that hires a medical assistant during flu vaccination season just to do flu vaccinations.
Like so, so they,
yeah. It's a temporary employee,
sure.
And there's enough of an administration fee as well as their commitment to quality that they can cover their expenses. And so that's a real practical way. I think that if you look at the big picture, if a physician can establish a protocol that takes some upfront work, but then means they don't have to look at each patient to give an individual order for influenza vaccine, it actually will save physician time and produce productivity. So I don't think there's a conflict with standing orders being a concern for reimbursement. And actually, I think it will enhance efficiency and has the potential to enhance reimbursement as well. Some patients do want the physician to manage their own care, but we can explain, the staff can explain that, hey, the physician approved this protocol. The quality assurance group is the one who came up with it, so it isn't something that is to be concerned. Malpractice is another fear that some places have. I don't think it's a major issue because it's covered by the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, a no-fault program that provides coverage for every approved vaccine that's on the recommended childhood and adolescent immunization schedules. So there's no issue, and that applies whether they're children or adults.
I'm not an attorney, but I haven't heard of a case that is related to this matter.
And these vaccines, we know these vaccines are so safe.
I agree.
Exactly. They're safe in terms of side effects for patients, and they're safe in terms of immediate events that might occur around the time of delivery. You know, I was also thinking that as we think about practices setting up programs to deliver vaccines, some office settings are just so small or they are constrained by resources. And I just wanted to also point out that sometimes it may be very appropriate for the provider to say, you know, we aren't set up, we don't have our express clinic or our walk-in clinic today, or we don't have the resources, but there's another setting where you can go and get your vaccination, and we think of pharmacies, we think of grocery stores, we think of other kinds of settings now. Sometimes we call them non-traditional or alternative settings, but they're also oftentimes very convenient and very safe places for patients to get some of these vaccines as well.
Okay, you guys, so you've convinced me. I'm the person you've convinced. I'm setting up a system in my office to do this. I've educated my nurses. We've got this down. But now the patients come in, and some of them have objections to immunization. So let's take a minute and talk about that. What sorts of concerns might they have, and what is it that you can do to overcome those hesitations?
Well, one of the concerns I hear actually being reported as much by providers as by patients themselves is the concern about vaccine safety.
Go.
Am I going to get sick from this vaccination? And Rick, just as you reported, I've heard this too. I don't want to get the flu from a flu shot. Well, we know that you can't get the flu from a flu shot. But more than that, we know that vaccines used in the United States today for adults and for children are very safe. And they're effective. So this gets back to the provider recommendation. Patients may have concerns about vaccine safety. That's very legitimate. But then we have to tell them this is a legitimate concern. But the good news is that these are safe vaccines. And I recommend it for you today.
So, Rick, I can't imagine anybody gets out of your office unvaccinated. But come on occasion, patients
yes,
give you a hard
happen.
Time.
They do. I tell my patients that I would take the vaccine, but I give it to my four children. And my wife takes it. It's a family affair.
Wow.
And I think we've done some studies, and particularly in some of the persons of color who went to our clinic, they did not realize that we recommended vaccination. And we have multiracial staff and board, but it did not cross. And so we've made a really targeted effort to make sure that all of our patients understand that we recommend vaccination. And at times, if we've sent out announcements via postcard or whatever about vaccination, we have tried to make that really clear because the provider recommendation is key. And there are data that suggest that people, patients want to know that their physician or their physician's office recommends it, not just the public health authorities, not just the Centers for Disease Control, but that it's their physician that recommends it.
Now, you call that a recommendation, but I call you an immunization advocate. You that's a recommendation on steroids, right? I mean, you really, you really impress upon the patient that you and your family have been immunized, and you want that level of protection for them also, right?
Yes.
You know, and I was just thinking something else that we can do as providers. We can practice what we preach, and we can make sure that we're immunized as well to influenza and the other vaccines recommended for us.
Right. I believe that. So we've talked a little bit about building an immunization program, about influenza immunization. Are there some other strategies that can work? I mean, we should try to make every visit to the healthcare provider an immunization review and immunizing visit, right?
Absolutely. I would also say remembering the good principles of continuous improvement and not only trying to incorporate assessment and vaccination into our practices, but remembering that we should pay attention, probably even assess how well our practice is doing so we can identify gaps and opportunities for improvement.
So if I tell you, if you ask me, so how well are we doing, Bill, what proportion of your patients are being immunized, I'm always going to tell you that, oh, yeah, we get them all or most of them. But we've learned, haven't we, and the studies are in the literature, that that enthusiasm or that response notwithstanding, if you actually go in and do an audit, we find out that some patients have escaped, right? Our success rate is not exactly as successful as we imagine it is. So numbers speak.
They do, and then they identify opportunities for improvement, and then, as you've said and as we've discussed, thinking about strategies such as standing orders, leveraging your EMR, making sure that we recommend, then we can help ourselves improve.
And Rick, you guys have a toolkit that you've actually promoted among primary care physicians in your areas.
Yes, we're testing a second round of that toolkit, a second version of it. It's available for free at immunizationed.org. And one of the things that we're doing right now is we are, in some practices, we're trying to raise the rates. We're giving them feedback on a missed opportunity index. And it's kind of interesting. We give them a weekly, this is the number of patients you've seen. This is the number you vaccinated. And then what's the difference? And we find that some practices will hit a 50, 60% of persons who visit, they will either have already vaccinated or vaccinate. Or we'll find occasionally some numbers in the 20s. And when you see a practice that uses 20% of their vaccination opportunities, where many others are 40 to 60%, that really shows the variation in practices and the fact that some practices are hitting 50 to 60% of the visits coming with vaccination and others are at 20, that you can make a difference. I realize that some people are too sick. They have acute pneumonia. We don't vaccinate them when they are that sick. I realize there are people coming in with crushing chest pain, and no, we don't pull out the flu vaccine for that. And there are some refusals. But when some practices are in the 60s for their missed opportunity chances, and others are in the 20s. We know those in the 20s can do a lot better, can get to 60.
Exactly.
So do you give the practices a goal? This is what we would like you to reach, or we think that this is an achievable goal?
We ask the practices to set their own goal, and then we track progress. We give them feedback on how they're doing. So they may set a goal, perhaps last year they gave 2,000 doses. We'll ask them to consider increasing from that 2,000 doses, 20%, 30%, whatever percentage increase, and then that we can plot that graph, that target, and see their progress. We also can do the missed opportunities look, and that's a comparative between practices. And we only tell them which practice is theirs, but they get the hint when they see the other practices are doing well and they're not doing so well. They get the hint, and then they change whatever they're doing. And I think that again, these two issues. You've got to identify people's vaccination status. What is it? And then have a systematic way to address it, such as standing orders or a smart set in an electronic medical record. If you put those two things together, you take care of those who come. And then I think, again, we have those who don't come in during the influenza vaccination season. We have to reach out to them with the reminders, with the phone calls by an auto dialer, and have the express services for them.
And I would just say, if we actually apply these principles, understand how well we're doing, and then implement a program, a practice can be successful. I would just say they need to actually address all the vaccines, and if you address influenza, your vaccination rates for other vaccines may not be where you'd want them to be. But if you have your practice develop a program incorporating all these elements that you've described, success rates as high as 80 to 90% have been described in some practices.
Well, that's great. And on this note, I think we've given our audience lots to think about, and we want to thank them all for participating in this activity. To proceed to the online CME test, click on the Earn CME Credit link on this page. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Strategies for Success in Adult Immunization. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.